You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good morning, everyone. Well, actually, it's just afternoon here.
So you could be listening to it anytime. So once again, we have a really interesting book and a great author to talk to today on Writers' Voices.
Yes.
Elena Hartwell is our author, and Three Strikes, You're Dead is the book. Elena Hartwell started out her storytelling career in the theater. She worked for several years as a playwright, director, designer, technician, and educator before becoming a novelist. Sounds like she did everything except act. She lives in North Bend, Washington with her husband, their trio of cats, and the greatest dog in the world, I'm guessing it's a big dog. When she's not writing, teaching writing, or talking about writing, she can be found at a farm down the road where she and her husband keep their horses. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Elena.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
And the title of the book is Three Strikes, You're Dead, an Eddie Shoes Mystery. And since the two previous books are One Dead, Two to Go, and Two Heads Are Deader Than One, I'm guessing you've got a numerical theme going here.
I do, and I'm always amused when people look at my titles and say, well, what's the first book? Often I just give them a look, and then they go, oh, I get it. One Dead is probably first.
Yep. So, Elena, tell us how long have you been writing, and what made you decide to write a mystery series?
So I really have been writing as long as I can remember. I, you know, was one of those kids who was, you know, writing stories in pencil on scraps of paper when I was a little kid. And so that really has always been a part of my life. And I always was a storyteller. I can remember as a middle school kid walking home with my friends, and I would tell these stories, and I would do the routine where I would tell a part of a story, and then I would ask them, okay, does the character, you know, go through the door or go around the house, you know, and they would then get to say, oh, they go through the door, and then I would make up the next part of the story. And so I've always sort of been a storyteller. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And so I've always been a storyteller. And then when I started college, I went into theater. And so sort of as a natural progression, I started writing for the theater. And so that's really how I became a playwright. So I often have said that, you know, I was a writer who worked in theater as opposed to I was driven to be a playwright. It really was sort of the combination of the two. So while I was working in the theater, I still always really wanted to write a novel. That always felt like a goal and, you know, there's sort of a permanence to it. And I was a very voracious reader. And so novels always sort of, I sort of held them up on a pedestal. And I always felt like I really wanted to be a novelist. And so I started working on my first novel in about 2007. And it had some good things about it. You know, I wasn't completely in the dark because I had been writing plays, but it's a very different thing. And so that first book, just it wasn't very marketable, but I learned a lot. But the big thing about why I write mysteries is that's the genre I love to read. I've always read mysteries. I started out as a really young kid. My granny was a big Toni Hillerman, Agatha Christie fan, and I sort of went through her books on her shelf. And you know, I loved the Rockford Files and Cagney and Lacey and all those sort of 70s Private Eye. And so that was really the genre that I loved. And so when I sat down to write novels, that was sort of the natural progression.
Did you ever write any plays that would be considered mysteries?
No. And you know, it's interesting. There are some, you know, obviously the longest running play in the West End production of Agatha Christie's Mousetrap has run for, I think it's 66 years. So clearly you can do a mystery on stage, but for the most part, it's not a very effective medium for a mystery. You know, one, you're sort of stuck in either a unit set where you do sort of the everybody's in the drawing room, you know, and you've got to figure the whodunit if everybody's there in the room. Or you have these long, sort of drawn out, no matter how fast you can move scenery, scene changes, and that can sort of drop tension. And so murder mysteries are a little bit complicated to stage in the theater. They're sort of not as successful. And so it just never really crossed my mind to try to force that genre onto the stage, even though that's where I was working. And so I wrote a variety of plays. The majority of them were very sort of heavily social issue oriented. So I have a lot of plays about post-traumatic stress disorder and veterans. And one of my most successful plays was actually about colony collapse disorder and the disappearance of bees. And so I had sort of a lot of heavy sort of social issues. And when I started working on this particular series, which was actually my fourth book, but the first one published, I went really light and kind of fun. And it was a great sort of break from 20 years of writing very serious stuff for the theater. Mm. So that was sort of fun, too, to go away from grappling with really big, serious issues to... even though I get to kill people, having a little bit lighter tone.
But it's all in good fun.
It is all in good fun. And, you know, and it's a nice balance. I like to think that it's a nice balance and that there are, you know, my social, you know, there are some social issues that sort of drift around in the background, but they're sort of peripheral. And so it still has a little bit of the things that are important to me strung throughout it.
Right.
But
right.
I get to just sort of enjoy myself.
Yeah, you touch briefly on police violence in this book, just very briefly. So
also, you know, my protagonist is half Latina, half Jewish. There's some issues around, you know, immigration and how we view people. But they are, again, it's not in the forefront. And so it's just sort of touched on. I sort of feel like, especially with this series, which is lighter, I like to sort of prompt people into thinking about things and realizing that there are people behind issues. So wherever you stand on an issue, you aren't just talking about a political stance. You're talking about individuals and their lives. And an impact on real people. And my hope is that by creating characters that feel real, people are now invested in that there's individuals behind some of these things that we're looking at.
You also, there was her father, the main character's father, Eduardo, is possibly mafia, maybe? Maybe not that
bad. He's quite a character. You know, I love Eduardo. And he does come in the first book, and... it was amazing to me. You know, you never know as a writer what people are going to respond to. And what was so interesting to me when that first book came out was everyone said, are we going to learn more about Eduardo? And I was surprised at how taken people were with him. And I'm sort of charmed by him, but I didn't realize that other people would be too. And so he does show up a little bit in book two, and then he gets a very big part in book three. And that was partly I wanted to do it, but it was also that a lot of readers were really interested in sort of learning a little bit more about him.
Well, he added a lot to the whole plot, to the whole thing of you know, everything around. I thought it was great.
I appreciate that. Yeah, I'm very fond of him.
So, Elena, do you have a similar heritage to Eddie?
I really don't. I am 3% Jewish, which I'm very proud of, and it's both Ashkenazi and Sephardic, so I'm very proud of my 3% Jewish heritage. But no, I really don't. I was born in Bogota, Colombia. My parents were in the Peace Corps, and so my first word was cuidado, which means careful in Spanish. And I think I've always had a little bit of an affinity for the language. And I grew up in San Diego, so I had a lot of interaction with people from Mexico, people that were had come over the border or had, you know, moved into the area. I was often in sort of rural areas as well, so I had a lot of interaction with sort of itinerant immigrant farm laborers and sort of saw the struggles that they had. And so I think I do sort of have an affinity for that community, but it was sort of a surprise that I created a character who, at least ethnically, is very different than I am.
Is it difficult at all, you know, to really maybe understand or get in that character's into their skin if you haven't mm-hmm. shared the experiences.
Yeah, you know, I think it's a really challenging question, and I think it's one that, as a white writer, you know, it's always sort of a question, I think, for those of us that are writing from a place of, you know, a very different sort of cultural experience. So the things that I do to try to be sort of thoughtful and sensitive now that this is the characters that I've created is, you know, one, I'm white. I don't know what it is to be brown or black in this culture, but I do know what it is to be a woman. I do understand what prejudice looks like. I do understand when you're judged by a physical component and, you know, expectations about how smart I am or how capable I am. So I do understand those kinds of issues. Secondly, I try to, read other stories by people of color. I try to, you know, talk to people of color and interact with people of color in a way where I can sort of understand where they're coming from. And then I also have created a character who is kind of on this interesting borderline. I was in a sociology class one time with a man whose last name was Hernandez. He looked very Latino, and it never occurred to me that he identified as anything else. And it came up in class one day about how we self-identify, and he said, I identify as white. And we were all sort of surprised. And he said, yeah, I know, I get that look a lot when people, you know, when this conversation comes up. And for him, he had a white mother. He grew up in a very white community. He went to basically all-white school. That was the culture that he sort of experienced. And what struck me about it was how differently we can see ourselves versus how culture sees us, and the complications regardless. And so with Eddie Shoes, she grew up with a white mother. She grew up in a white community. And while she did experience some negative behavior towards her because of what she looked like, her identity isn't as clear. And so she is sort of exploring what that side of her history is, as a way that she's not any kind of expert either. And so she's a little bit of an outsider in both community. And so that allows me as a writer to kind of be exploring what that means with her. And simultaneously, her mother is exploring her Jewish ancestry and her Jewish history. And so she's also learning that aspect of her background. And so my characters are not experts in either. And that allows me as a writer to kind of be exploring that and letting my characters explore that as a way to try to be, you know, I'm not here to tell anybody what it's like. I'm only here to say here is one character and one experience, and this is how, you know, her life is based on some of these characteristics, if that makes any sense at all.
Oh, definitely. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Elena Hartwell, author of Three Strikes, You're Dead, and Eddie Shoes Mystery. You mentioned, I think you said that the first Eddie Shoes story, The One Dead, Two to Go, was actually the fourth book you wrote?
Yeah, I think, yeah. You know, it's so interesting being a writer, and I teach a lot of writing courses, and I do one-on-one with writers, and I work a lot with young writers, so I sort of see this experience over and over and over again, and one of the things that's really interesting to me about writing is that I think for a lot of people, there's this expectation that if you can put sentences together, you can write a book. And that's just simply not true. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like saying, well, I can put paint on a canvas, therefore I can do a painting that's worthy of hanging in the Louvre. I mean, it just isn't how it works. And so there were a couple things that I really had to learn. So here I was, a playwright, and I've had productions done around the U.S. and and abroad, and I've had some plays published, and I've had some success as a playwright. But I went to go write a novel and realized, even though I was a longtime reader and even though I already was a writer, like, I had a lot to learn about how books work, how mysteries work, and how a series work, because those are all really different things. To write a standalone is not the same as writing a series. And so I had a lot to learn. So the first book I wrote, again, it actually had some things that worked really well, but It was a little wandry. It was a little slow. Like, I definitely didn't have pace down. I made some choices with the character that weren't the strongest. And I worked very hard on it, and I did a lot of rewriting. And I even worked with an independent editor to kind of discover what I was doing right and wrong. And that helped a lot. So I wrote my second book, which was actually not a mystery at all. It was a historical novel, which was not a bad book. And again, I learned a lot about how to structure a novel. It is a standalone, so that was, you know, interesting experience. It's more like writing a play to write a standalone. But again, it just had some flaws to it. So then I wrote my third book, which was also a mystery and was designed to be the first in the series. And it did actually fairly well. I got an agent, and it was pitched to all the big houses. And, you know, we got some really phenomenal no's. But there is such a thing.
Some wonderful no's.
A phenomenal no. You know, so it would be things like, wow, you know, we really love this book, but we just put out something similar, or, you know, this is a great book, but we'd like to see the ending changed, or, you know, this book clearly has a place out there, but it's not quite where we, you know, what we do. So it was a kind of, you know, a lot of times, sometimes you don't even hear back at all. Even agents don't hear back at all. So we were getting these really great, you know, like, no's.
Great
but ultimately it did not sell. And so while that was going on, I wrote this book. I wrote the first Eddie Shoes, and then that went as a three-book series. So, yeah, I think all of us have books in drawers. You know, I know some really well-known, successful authors who wrote, you know, even 10 and 11 books before the first one sold. So I actually feel pretty lucky to have only
Well, you know,
written.
John Grisham's first book didn't sell, and...
Yeah.
Then after books sold, he was able to publish that first.
Go back and well, we've learned something, so we go back and fix. I think some of the yeah. Jonathan Kellerman is a sort of well known the writer's mythology of having written numerous books before his first came out, and then of course he's done, you know, a book a year for whatever it is, 20 years. So
how long does it take you to write a book?
I can write a book in a year. I'm not sure that's the best schedule for me. Mm. I think I would love to do more like one every 18 months.
Okay.
I can do a book in a year. Did I lose you? Oh, there we go.
So in the, what kept you going writing books? 1, 2, 3 to get to the one that was successful.
It's so funny that you asked that because I just started reading a book yesterday that is about overcoming like injuries if you're an athlete. It's called The Champion's Comeback. And I was thinking as I was reading it how incredibly applicable that is to being a writer. Mm. It's almost like having a, you know, writing a novel and having it rejected either by an agent or once you have an agent by publishers, it's a little like being an athlete and getting injured. And I think you have to ask yourself, what do I need to do to overcome? Like, there's sort of two options. You decide you're done and you leave the industry, or you get back up, you figure out what you learned, and you come back stronger. And I think sort of the two primary things that really worked for me is I was never not working on the next book. So as soon as I had finished one and I was sending that out, I was working on the next book. So there never was sort of this, I often hear people talk about, well, I have to get this book published. And the answer is, well, no, you really don't. You don't have to get that book. One, it's not your choice for a publisher to say yes. And two, you're not going to die. It will not kill you if that book does not get published. But you really should be writing the next one that might. And so first there was that. So I was always working on the next book. The second thing is, as a playwright, you get rejected constantly. You know, you have a play that might get produced at 100 theaters, but there's 100 more that said no to you before that 100 theaters said yes. And so as a playwright, the expectation is you're going to get turned down over and over and over again for that one theater that's going to produce you. And so I already had the mindset of, you know, it's okay if it gets turned down. Someone else may say yes. And so, I think those two things, I have this history of understanding that rejection is not personal and it's not permanent. Rejection is in the moment with a person or a publisher, a agent, and it doesn't define you, it doesn't define the project. And so I think if that can be your mindset, rejection is a bump in the road instead of a, giant wall
Right,
that you've just hurled yourself against going 90 miles an hour.
Well, I suppose all authors face that rejection thing, don't they? I mean,
Yeah.
do you know of anyone that never got a rejection letter?
No, I really don't. And even, it's so interesting. I work with a lot of debut authors in different ways, and even debut authors where their very first book sold, right? So the very first book that they finish and publish sold, and sometimes does very well, wins awards and all this other stuff. If you look at their history, they were a journalist and they wrote articles for 20 years honing their skills, and their articles were turned down, or they were rejected by multiple agents before someone bought their first book. So even people who quote unquote publish their first book, even they have experienced rejection. It's very rare for someone to write their first book, pitch it to one agent, that agent says yes, the agent pitches it to one publisher, that publisher says yes. It just doesn't happen. There's always a level of negative things happening. And then once the book is out, you're up for an award and you don't win, or you get a bad review. And that is also a form of rejection. And so you have to be able to
Oh, yeah.
handle the fact that there are going to be people who aren't going to like your work. And it's painful. I'm not going to lie to you. It doesn't feel good. But the reality is, if no one hates your work, probably no one loves your work. It's probably sort of in the middle. And there's something sort of exciting about, somebody who's like, this is the greatest book I've ever read. But that doesn't mean anything if someone else isn't sort of like, wow, I really hated it.
Wow.
People feel passionately about things that are not in the middle. If you are sort of an average, mediocre writer, you're going to have a lot of people that like your work, but probably no one who really loves it.
I never really thought about that. That if,
Yeah,
yeah, if
that's
somebody,
interesting.
if people are going to love it, other people are going to hate it. You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Elena Hartwell, author of Three Strikes, You're Dead, and Eddie Shue's Mystery. So you set out to write a series, and how is that different from writing a standalone book?
So different. And of course, as a playwright, everything's a standalone. It's very rare to write a series for the theater, unless you're doing it in sort of like a late night, sort of recurring sort of show. Other than that, plays are all standalone. But mysteries are so often series. I mean, that's a huge part of the genre. And I've always been very attached to character. I love all the Sid Grafton, and I tend to read, I loved all the Tony Hillerman, Jim Chee, so I attached to characters. And so I thought, well, I think that would be sort of the way to go. And what I really learned on the first book was how much you don't need to include in a first book. So the stuff that you can let unfold, one of the questions, that gets asked or is brought up by my series is my character Eddie Shoes has a had a previous relationship with a man, a ex a, her ex is a homicide detective who moves to Bellingham where she lives, and so there's the question of will they rekindle their relationship. And of course we all know if the relationship kindles, that's sort of the end of things. Right? I mean, it's the spark that drives us. And so, for example, in dealing with just that one issue of do they, don't they get back together again, okay, I have to really be thoughtful about it has to be enough growth that people stay engaged, but not so much that it answers the question, because at that point, we're no longer wondering what happens. And so I had to learn a lot about, how do you sprinkle in just enough backstory to make the character feel real, but without dumping sort of everything that you know about this character that things can wait, and how much things will evolve. So things that I thought were going to be in books, later books, I've realized, oh, that's not actually how the character evolved. And so sort of, you know, you want to drop in clues of what's going to happen down the road, but be flexible as a writer to know that may not ultimately be what happens, and that you're going to have to be flexible in changing up what you thought was going to be real. So it was a lot. There was a lot for me to learn in that aspect.
So I'm guessing that you started with the character, with the detective, private investigator, Eddie Shoes. And what about her, what is it about her that made you want to write a series around her?
Yeah, why did I want to hang out with her? Well, I'll tell you, I love her evolution. So my husband and I were on a road trip, and apropos of nothing, my husband came up with this name, Eddie Shoes. I mean, really, like, not connected to anything. And I'm not even sure why. I try to remember. I'm like, it might have been an Eddie Money song was on the radio. It could have been that. But he says the name Eddie Shoes, and I said, oh, my God, Eddie Shoes, that's a private investigator. That is a great name for a private investigator. And that's where her character started. So it literally was her name. And so my first thought was, well, she didn't come into the world Eddie Shoes. And my next thought was, her name is Edwina Zapata Schultz. And I thought, well, isn't that interesting? She's clearly, you know, Jewish and Latina. And, you know, who is this person that's her name? And so that was sort of her evolution. And so once I started kind of getting to know her, and what she's like, then I just had to have somebody die, and that she could investigate. And so it really, truly, all three books came from her first. And on book three, I sent her on vacation, because I've been killing people in Bellingham, Washington, and they only really have one murder a year. So I had to stop killing people in Bellingham, Washington for a little while, so I sent her on vacation. And that was fun, too, because I got to take her out of her sort of her safe zone and put her where she doesn't have her usual resources or her usual friends or what she knows. And so it's been really fun to kind of sit back and say, how does Eddie respond in different situations, and how are her relationships evolving over the course of these books? Mm. So luckily for me, she ended up being a character that I really enjoy spending time with, and so I can hang out for another 300 pages.
Now, in mysteries, more so than in a lot of genres, plot really mm-hmm. has to drive the book. You know, there are some books that can be completely character-driven.
Yeah.
But a mystery, you've got to have, something happen, and you have to tie up the loose ends at the end.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about your process for plotting the mystery.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I often teach structure classes with people, and so these kinds of questions are always something I'm sort of grappling with, not just as a writer, but as a teacher, and how do I sort of verbalize it or present it for people. And one of the things that I think we forget is that plot and character in a novel are inextricably linked. You don't have one without the other, because character is revealed to us by how they react in any given situation. That's how we understand character. Whether that is in a physical action or an emotional reaction or a thought process, that's still how the character reacts. And so for us to understand character, we are required to have an event. And all a plot is a series of events strung together. And they are a series of events which are required and impacted by what happened before. And so those two things can't happen in isolation. And so while I totally agree with the premise that some of us sort of start from character and some of us sort of start from story, I mean, that's really true, and I've seen that over and over again. Once we have our starting place, the other two have to come together hand in hand. And so whether it's sorting out the events and seeing how the character responds, or knowing the character and seeing what events they go into, the end product is going to be the same. That what we're looking at is a series of events that are getting more and more important with higher and higher stakes, and the characters reacting in a specific way. And what we want to see in a mystery, and in any genre, but in a mystery, is what gets uncovered, how do we solve that crime, and why does it matter, you know, why does it matter to us, how does the dangers get greater? And I would argue that even if you looked at a genre that's not a mystery, maybe something literary, that's slower moving and slower paced and doesn't have that sort of sense of you know, action, that underlying that, you're still really looking at event to event to event. It's just they may be more of a psychological event, or they may, the stakes may not be life and death, but that on some level, those things are still happening, just at a slightly varying degree. Does that make sense?
When you start writing, do you know who done it and why?
I actually, with the second book, I got to the end of the first draft and realized that I had, one, killed the wrong person, and two, the wrong person had done it. So I really had to go back. So the story was sort of the same, but, you know, who had committed the crime was sort of different. So I sort of knew. I'm a very organic writer. I tend to know where it starts and where it ends. And so what's fun for me is to figure out all of those little steps in between, because there's so many different ways to go. I always talk about writing a book as being like a map, and I'm starting in Los Angeles and I'm ending in New York, and I know LA and I know New York, and so there's no question for me about LA and New York, but all the different routes that you could take is where the excitement comes from. And that's why I call that organic, you know, an organic writer. And sometimes you get part way and you realize, oh, I should not have gone through Chicago. I should have gone through Nashville. And you have to go back, retrace your steps, and change the route. For people who are more, you know, what we call a plotter, a person who outlines, they're actually doing the exact same thing. But instead of getting in the car and starting the drive and making changes as they go, they're at home with the map, and they're figuring out all the steps that they want to take and erasing bad choices and making new ones, and they've got their map all plotted out, and then they get in the car and start to drive. We all start in LA and end up in New York.
It seems like your way's more fun and the other way's more efficient.
I think that's a really good assessment. And Lee Chow once said, and I love this, Lee was asked, you know, if he was a, you know, if he outlined, and he said, no, that would take out the excitement of sitting down every morning and finding out what happens next.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, you know, hey, if it works for Lee Chow, I'm good with my process.
Well,
so,
Elena, why don't you read? Oh, Mom, go ahead.
I was going to ask her if she had talked to other mystery writers, and if they know the endings when they start.
Yeah. I think really the most common thing that I hear, and I interact with a lot of mystery writers. I do a lot of interviews on my blog, and I go to a lot of conferences, and I have a lot of friends that are mystery writers. And we almost all, regardless of whether people are outlining or not, I think most of us are like, we know where it starts, we kind of know where it ends, and whether you are figuring it out by writing it on the page or you're figuring it out by outlining, in my experience, and again, this is my experience, but in my experience, when I work with new writers who can't finish a book, and that's really common, people start off with a bang and then they get muddled up and lost, the number one problem is they don't know the ending. And if you can get them to figure out an ending, even if it's going to change, it doesn't matter for that first draft, even if it's going to change, they figure out an ending, then they're able to go back and write the middle because they have a direction. It's a little bit like, you know, there's that theory that the human mind does best with seven things, right? Like phone numbers are easy to remember because you can do seven. You can't do more than that.
Oh.
And that when we have too many choices in front of us, we stall out. We like three options. We don't want 20. And I think what happens for writers is they start off this great story and they get kind of in the middle, and then there are so many directions that they can go, they absolutely freeze and stop.
Mm-hmm.
And if you know the ending, then that limits the ways that you can get there, and that can get you focused in and honed in and allow you to finish that first draft. So, yeah, I think the majority of us definitely know the ending.
I think that's very wise. I can definitely see that in my own experience, too.
Yeah. Well, and to go back to the car analogy, you would be like saying, okay, you're in L.A., off you go. Okay. Where am I heading? Well, that's up to you. Well, that's a terrible way to start a road trip. You know,
yeah.
Even if you're going to have a lot of options, like, are you going to even if it's just, okay, head to the East Coast, you know, as opposed to, you know, head to Canada. So
right.
So I think that you need to have some semblance of an ending.
And yeah. At some point you have to narrow it down too.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really is all about making choices. The other thing I see with writers, a really common error in an early draft, is they get stuck with, well, I can't go on until this chapter's perfect. I can't go on until this chapter's perfect. And I will say to them, well, you don't know how the book ends, so how can the opening chapter be perfect? That's impossible. So the fact that you are rewriting chapter one over and over and over again to make it perfect is why you will never, ever, ever finish this book. You will never finish this book.
You are right.
So, I hope so, because I've told a lot of people that.
Well, Elena, why don't you read a little bit from the opening of Three Strikes, You're Dead?
I would love to. So I'm just going to start right off at chapter one. As a private investigator, I often deal with the misery of others. And while that's way better than dealing with my own misery, I was still looking forward to a few relaxing days surrounded by the beauty of the Cascade Mountains. My plan was to worry about nothing more serious than whether to have a latte or a cocktail in the late afternoon. Besides my clients and the attention they required, the circle of people in my life were demanding more and more of my time. I wasn't sure how I felt about not being as footloose and fancy-free as I had been for so many years. Relationships require care, and I wasn't totally convinced I was up to the challenge. Being a grown-up wasn't all it was cracked up to be. Back in March, my mother, Shava, had started working security for a casino not far from my Bellingham home. She excelled in her new job, able as she was to sniff out shuffle trackers and con men with the instincts of a bloodhound. Recently rewarded for her vigilance with a hike in pay after her 3-month probationary period ended at the beginning of June, she generously offered up a mother-daughter getaway weekend to celebrate at the newly renovated Wenatchee Valley Hot Springs Resort and Spa. Her success was further proof that she had no intention of returning to her beloved Las Vegas anytime soon, or that my guest room would return to being my home office in the near future. Apparently, I now had a full-time roommate. Currently, that roommate was crouched over the wheel of her bright red Mazda 6 zooming up the road toward our destination. "You've been down in the mouth ever since that thing with Dakota Fontaine," she'd said last week when she brought up the idea. "I thought you could use a long weekend away." Just before Shava started her new job, an old friend from my Spokane childhood had shown up in Bellingham bringing Sturm and Drong with her. The whole adventure had made me a little cranky. Besides, I thought at the time, why turn down a mini vacation with the added bonus I could make my mother happy? And as the resort was dog-friendly, we got to take Franklin, my 175-pound Tibetan Mastiff Irish Wolfhound cross. So I said yes. An hour into our drive, we passed through Monroe, a town of slightly over 20,000 souls. It had sprung up along the railroad 100 years ago. Once we got through town, we stopped for lattes at the Café Corral, a small roadside stand in the parking lot of the Reptile Zoo. One of these days, I'd stop and visit Reptile Man and his animals, but today we were winging our way up Highway 2, heading into the mountains. Road trips always felt like an opportunity for a do-over, a restart button to erase life's inevitable messy complications. Even if my destination was a place I'd never been, a place where no one knew me, I could begin afresh. A new romance, a new job, I could be an orphan. Chava began singing loudly to the radio, and I slammed back into the here and now, her presence tethering me to my current existence, regardless of our distance from home. Life could be worse, though. I could be paying for this little getaway. I was more excited than I wanted to admit. Shav and I had rarely been on destination vacations together. We'd visited each other in our respective cities over the years, but seldom gone to another location entirely. I'd found excuses to tell everyone I knew that we were going. My best friend is, because I had to cancel our Saturday morning workout session at the dojo. Debbie Buse, in case you've been thinking about meeting at the dog park on Sunday. And Chance Parker, my ex-boyfriend from Seattle, who'd taken a job as a police detective in Bellingham last December. After several tries over the course of the week, I'd run into him at Rustic Coffee in Fairhaven and ask him what his weekend plans were. I figured social etiquette would make him ask me about mine. I'm taking a few days off and going up to Orcas Island, he said. Do a little carpentry. A friend's cabin needs a new roof. Chance was pretty good with home repair projects, so I wasn't surprised, though I wondered about the friend. Should be lovely up there, I said. What's the cabin like? And more importantly, who's the owner? Primitive, Chance said with a laugh. We won't have electricity or cell service. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but James is used to surviving in the wilderness, and a few days of roughing it won't hurt me. I remember James. He lived in Alaska and took people out to look at bears and walrus nose and live on sticks and berries. Very manly, I said. What about you, Chance asked, proving my expectation about social niceties. I explained about the trip Shava had planned for us. Sounds like fun, he said. You'll have to tell me all about it when you get back. That was a good sign, right? Almost like asking me out on a date. Why don't we get together, I said, emboldened by his easy manner, when we're both back. Compare notes on our respective long weekends. Sure, he said. We'll figure something out. That was a yes, right? You're smiling, Shava said, as we reached the outskirts of Sultan, the first small town after Monroe, and had to slow down. I'm content, I said, a little surprised to discover it was true. The distinctly western Washington small towns whizzed by outside the windows. Startup, Gold Bar, Bering, places with grocery stores and ski rentals mixed in with taverns and restaurants, all of which had seen better days. Not to mention the string of funky espresso drive-thrus, including a windmill, a barn, and a tiny brick building, all with clever names. After Google and Amazon, coffee was the most popular business in our area. Or maybe all that coffee was why we had the tech business to begin with. Stands of evergreens mixed with deciduous trees covered in moss stretched along the banks of the Skykomish. The rushing westbound river competed for space with a railroad track and the road we were on in the corridor up to Stevens Pass. We crossed bridges with the river underneath us and sped under bridges with the railroad overhead, sometimes occupied by a moving train. I could feel my tension ease as we left civilization behind. The trees were green, the river was clear as glass, first reflecting the sky, then turning into rapids, then forming deep, quiet pools in the eddies of a bank. Franklin snoozed contentedly in the back seat, chin tucked under one armrest, feet pressed against the door on the other side. A green sign flashed by, Stevens Pass, elevation 4,061, as we raced alongside the ski resort. Summer had turned the snow-covered paths into bare wounds with the zigzag of ski lifts stitching them together. Shava hurtled over the crest and swooped down the other side like a downhill skier setting a record. Though I'd never admit it, it was always fun being her passenger. Off in the distance, a thin column of smoke appeared. The plume rose straight up from the dense forest before fading into a gauzy haze and disappearing altogether. A resident probably had a burn pile going. That was how many of the locals disposed of trash or yard waste. It could also be part of a planned burn designed to clear dangerous underbrush before a spark from a careless camper or a zap of summer lightning lit the mass of tinder. The rest of the sky was clear as far as I could see. Despite the treacherous and fast-spreading wildfires common here in the western United States, there were none currently raging in the Cascades. I'd checked into that before we left. There was one burning in Utah, but nothing in our area. Fire season began in summer and could go into October, depending on conditions. Human beings started most early season wildfires, but luckily that hadn't happened this year. We'd also had record-setting snowfall the previous winter and a cool spring, which helped delay the start. What do you see out there? Any signs of Bigfoot? Chava's voice broke into my thoughts. Only the carved wooden one outside the espresso chalet, I said, referring to the statue near Index, a tiny community we'd passed just before we crossed the King County line. But the scenery is beautiful. It's something, isn't it? Breathtaking, I said. Thank you for this. She smiled and scanned through the stations on the radio again. Driving with Java meant sampling a wide variety of musical styles. She paused to groove with some hip-hop group I'd never heard of and pop over to a country station, putting her best twang into a duet with Tammy Wynette before landing on an aria from Rigoletto. At least with the aria, she didn't try to sing harmony. I began to hum along with the melody of an old Eagles tune. It was going to be a perfect getaway. What could possibly go wrong?
And we shall soon find out.
There's some hints there in that opening about what might go awry.
Yes, there certainly are. There certainly are. Now, this is set in northwestern Washington?
Yeah, so the series, she lives in Bellingham, which is a college town not far from the Canadian border there on the coast. And so I have sent her on vacation to a fictional resort outside a town called Leavenworth. And Leavenworth, Washington is very real. It's a wonderful vacation destination. It's a lot like Solvang, California, or New Glarus, Wisconsin, in that it is built as a, it was rebuilt as a Bavarian sort of alpine community. So back in the, I think it's the 1960s, they weren't having a lot of luck. Timber industry was going down and all that. And so they decided, hey, let's make this into a Bavarian community. And they rebuilt buildings, and it's all very quaint. And, you know, they have like big light ceremonies in the around the holidays, and you can go and have great brats and beer. And it's what I really like about Leavenworth is it manages to be cute without being cutesy. You know what I mean? Like, it's charming and lovely. It's not overwhelming and tacky. It's just adorable community and flowers everywhere, and it's just really charming. And so it was kind of fun to juxtapose a murder against that sort of light, you know, vacation kind of area.
And of course, you're very familiar with the locations for this series.
I am. I live in the tiny town of North Bend, which for the Twin Peaks fans out there, that is the town that Twin Peaks is filmed in.
Oh.
So I live in the actual Twin Peaks, and that's about I'm about 90-minute drive from Bellingham, and a little over that to get to Leavenworth, not because it's further, but because you have to go out kind of a two-lane highway.
So do you, when you're writing about a specific area, do you go there to refresh your memory? You know, like this
I
trip, did
do.
you take the you took the road trip yourself?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it's, you know, I love it because what I typically do is like I'll been to the area and I'll write a draft and then I'll go back to the area while I'm doing notes, and so I can add the specifics. For example, the reptile house that I referenced. That's a real place, and I had sort of forgotten about it. And I had gone out to do the drive that they take, and I thought, oh yeah, that's such a great local detail. You know, I'll incorporate that in. And so, and I have a rule for myself, which is if a crime takes place somewhere, it's been fictionalized. So I don't kill anybody in a real place. But if there are clues or if there are events happening where there's not a crime, then that is probably a real place.
Okay.
So that's how I sort of navigate not, you know, taking a great little restaurant and having somebody murdered in the back. So a lot of places are very real.
Now, it's you mentioned earlier that this location is perhaps a little bit limiting for your series because not very many murders occur in Bellingham.
Yeah, I very early on I looked at statistics, and statistically they have one murder a year. And so my books, the first three are 3 months apart, are each sort of 3 months apart. And so for book three, I was like, well, I know, I'll just send her on vacation. And what amuses me is, of course, Leavenworth doesn't really have any murders. I figure I can get away with one. But it is something that I sort of think about in terms of, you know, do I need to put more time in between events, like between book three and book four? And I don't want to end up sort of the famous Jessica Fletcher Murder, She Wrote, Cabot Cove, where 300 murders happen in this tiny little seaside town.
Right.
Maybe just requiring a little too much suspension of disbelief. So I am sort of conscious about, you know, creating this sort of murder spree in relatively sleepy Bellingham.
Well, are your books popular in Bellingham?
Yes, although I had a very funny comment. At least I thought it was funny of a reader from Bellingham who was, oh, you know, I love the book and the characters are so great and it's so much fun. But you've set up that there's a mob guy in Bellingham and that just would never happen. And I was sort of amused because my first thought was, well, it's fiction and you enjoyed the book, so why is that sort of a sticking point? And my second part was, anytime you have a casino, there's always sort of a question that there could be something going on untoward, going on. And so it was a very funny, but it also was sort of that remembrance of, when people know an area, and I get a lot of comments about, oh, I love how accurate you are, and I knew exactly where this took place, and this is, I've been there. And so people will really respond to how accurate I am and those details that I include. But simultaneously, that is also the same group of people that are going to say, hey, wait a minute, that wouldn't happen here, or that doesn't quite work here. And so it's one of those funny sort of catch-22s of, it is fiction, so we can't be totally accurate. If we relayed how crime investigations take place by the police, you would never ever read a police procedural. It's incredibly slow.
Oh,
It takes
yeah.
months and years, But some of our favorite mysteries are these police procedurals where things happen at this really sort of sped up pace. And you just have to accept it because it's fiction. What makes the story exciting and good. And so I'm okay with accepting that I kill a few too many people in Bellingham, and I may have brought the mob in for book one.
Now, I didn't know there was a casino. Is in Bellingham, is gambling legal in Washington State?
Well, in Washington State, anytime you're on a Indian reservation, you can
Okay.
have a
Yeah,
casino.
we
So
have
that's
that in
right,
Iowa
right.
too. Yeah.
And then there also are a number that are not Native American. And actually, it was sort of interesting when I was creating. So the casino that takes place that's in book one is a fictional version of an actual casino in the area. But I very deliberately chose to make it not on a Indian reservation because it didn't feel right to have a crime on an Indian reservation. It didn't quite fit the story I was telling. It would have brought in a different set of the authorities would have been different because it would have been on a reservation as opposed to being out.
Right.
And so in Washington State, there are a number of casinos that are actually not on any reservations. We have a little bit of both. We have a mix of both. But we do have a fair number of casinos because we have a fairly strong population of Native American communities.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
Now, the Eddie and her mother seem like they're working together. Will this continue? Well, first of all, are there more books planned in the series?
Yes.
And will the two of them continue working together to solve mysteries?
Yeah, they certainly are. I like to say I think I have the only mother-daughter crime-fighting duo in the mystery genre, and I love that. I do. I love it. I love their dynamic. And we have seen in the past we've seen fathers and sons, and so I think there's something really fitting about letting mother and daughter take center stage. They do. And what's interesting, one of the things that's interesting to me, people often ask, how much is Java like my mother? And the answer is that she's really nothing like her. But what the model is my mom and I have this very close relationship. We're very good friends. We travel together. She reads all my stuff before anyone else does. And so we have this great relationship. And so Shava and Eddie are learning that they can have that too. So they're sort of on the journey to become like my mother and I are. So my mom and I are kind of the model for me of what a really strong mother-daughter relationship can be as adults. And Shava and Eddie are figuring out what that means. And so that's sort of the correlation between me and my mom and Eddie. But I always say, well, my mom doesn't play poker. She was never kicked out of Vegas, doesn't smoke, and doesn't know anyone in the mob. Other than that,
Other than that, she's your mom.
she's exactly like the characters of the book. Yeah.
Now, mysteries, there's several subgenres to mysteries.
Yeah.
And which one does yours fit in, or does it straddle a couple of them?
That is a great question, and I think an important one. Technically, I write private eye, and that is a subgenre. We tend to think of it a little bit more. Well, oftentimes people think, hard-boiled or noir, and that's not quite what this is. But if you think about Sue Grafton, A is for Alibi, B is for Burglar, and her character, Kinsey Millhone. My books absolutely fit into her, you know, the same sort of category, a lot like Janet Ivanovich, whose character is a bounty hunter, but she's, you know, funny, a little bit lighter. There's, you know, crimes are happening, but it's not sort of gory or dark. So that is very much the genre I fit in. But I have a lot of crossover with what are called cozy mysteries. And cozy mysteries, the reason mine is not a cozy is my character is a professional.
Ah.
And cozy requires an amateur sleuth. But there are some other characteristics that I share. First off, Chava, because she participates, is an amateur, and so she has a little bit of that crossover. But I don't have graphic sex or violence in my books, and that is another requirement of a cozy. And so when I ask, I say I write a private eye series with a crossover for cozy readers.
Very good.
How did it get the name Cozy?
I think, and don't quote me on this, but I think it came from tea cozy. From that they would serve tea and sort of the tea cozy and the idea of the, you know, it originated sort of Agatha Christie, the British writers, where the, you know, the sort of often elderly female sleuth was sort of knew everything going on in the community and you know, then she
and
would be a tea drinker.
Tea.
And so I think it came from tea. Yeah. But I, like I said, don't quote me on that. I would double check it. But I think that's where the word came from. And it's spelled differently, U.S. and England. You'll see C-O-Z-Y and C-O-S-Y. But I think that's where that
so
came
So how
from.
Many more Eddie Shue mysteries should we look forward to?
I could tell you, but I'd have to kill you. I'm just kidding there. I will just say that I'm working on book four.
Great.
All right.
Great. And do you find, you know, the work of promoting your current books, does that distract from the writing of the next one, or does it motivate you more?
Oh, you have just asked the $64,000 question, the topic that all writers, we all cringe. You know, promotion and marketing is really hard. It's a different skill set. It's not what most of us are good at. It's a challenge. We all vary in sort of how good we are at it, what we're comfortable with, what we're able to do, and the time. And so for me, I love doing public stuff. I love doing interviews. I love doing workshops and panels and interacting with readers. Like, I'm good at that. I'm not shy. So those things are easy for me, whereas a lot of writers, that's
right.
Very difficult. Yeah, you know, a real shy person, that is a challenge. So I'm lucky in that part is easy. I'm not great with social media. I have to sort of, you know, I'm always researching. Now, how does a hashtag work? I have a brilliant niece who is the perfect age, and she sat down and actually went through how to use Instagram with me, which was sort of huge because I was not doing it right, you know. So I'm lucky. I'm lucky to have some people to sort of help me with that. But yeah, that is definitely a challenge. It is. You know, you had asked if it helped sort of motivate you. It does. In the sense that I think most writers are really aware of our own responsibility for promoting our work. You know, gone are the days where you got in with a big publisher and they would send you on the book tour and really promote your book. And yes, it still happens. And no, it didn't always happen for every writer, but I think that was sort of the much more of the norm.
Well, Elena, we are unfortunately out of time. It's been such a pleasure talking to you today. And
it has been a delight.
And Mom, do you have some final words of wisdom for us?
Well, you know, this mystery is interesting. It's not normal, but normal is an illusion. What is normal to the spider is chaos to the fly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you.